Hello, welcome to The Addict's Advocate, a podcast geared towards the suffering addict and those in recovery. This podcast does not provide any medical advice. No material on this podcast is intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare professional with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a new healthcare regimen. And never disregard professional medical advice or delay in seeking it because of something you have heard on this podcast. Enjoy the show. Hello, friends, and welcome to The Addict's Advocate. I am your host, Dusty Dean, and this is our inaugural episode, our inaugural interview. So I'm very excited about this, and more importantly, I'm excited to have my guest, Counselor Michael Hamilton. How are you doing this evening, sir?
I'm really doing well. Thank you for having me.
Good, good, good. Well, I appreciate the opportunity for you to be the first and hopefully a long series of interviews with individuals such as yourself, as well as people that are in recovery that have struggled with addiction in the past. The idea here with this podcast is purely that we're going to hopefully give empowerment, give enlightenment to those who are suffering, maybe families, members of those that are suffering, and get a true understanding of what this whole thing called addiction truly is, how it affects our brains, how it affects our lives, and how we can find a way to basically, you know, get it behind us and move forward with a clean and sober lifestyle. So with that, I'm not going to waste any time here. And I just am curious as to, you know, a little background on yourself. You know, what drove you to become a therapist?
Well, you know, it first started, I was in the Navy for 21 years. And in 1979, I decided to go to what they call the Navy Safety Action Program, right, as a student. And I liked it so much, I inquired on how to facilitate it. And this is a prevention education program, right? So I started in 1979 in prevention. However, it's really difficult to tell whether prevention is really working because there's no way to measure that, right? There's no way to measure whether the education is actually reaching the people because you want to prevent them from developing an addiction or a problem. So in 1984, I graduated or I transported over to the treatment side and went to the Navy Drug and Alcohol Counseling School in 1984. So I'm a graduate of what they call NDACS. And ever since 1984, I've been a counselor in some way, shape, or form, three counties, for-profit, non-profit, faith-based organizations, hospitals, so on and so forth. So it's been a pretty long journey since 1984.
Very good. Very good. That's pretty fascinating. So you're looking at a good, you know, three decades plus doing this.
Huh? Yes. Yes.
Okay. Okay. What is your overall approach to someone who has addiction issues and is looking for some way out? How do you approach a person walking off the street, for example?
Yeah, I really like that question because one of the things I found out is that it's really incumbent upon me as a clinician that wants to be of help. I have to meet the individual where they are, not where I think they should be. Excuse me. So part of that is knowing what they're going through, their struggles and all of those things. But number one, I have to be able to listen, actively listening to what's going on with them, not to jump to any conclusions. So what I found, Dustin, is that I have to suspend judgment. So when I meet somebody, I have to, for that period of time, however long we're going to be together, I need to suspend what I think is going on and talk to that individual one-on-one to the degree that I never read somebody's assessment before they arrive in the program. I always watch them and look at them as they arrive, and then I come to my own conclusions. And I've been pleasantly surprised by people who didn't present themselves as their assessment indicated.
Interesting, interesting. So let's say I were to come to you and say, you know, I'm kind of wondering, I've been drinking for a good part of a decade now. And to be honest with you, that, you know, for the most part during the week, I'm good. Sure, on the weekends, I go to the clubs, go out with my friends, hang out, have a good time, Usually need to Uber it home because I've probably drank too much and trying to be responsible. Mm-hmm. Right. But you know, lately, maybe the hangovers have been 2-3 days now, instead of just, you know, waking up early and getting on with my day the next day. Mm-hmm. But you know, I don't know if I want to stop. How do I know if I'm going to go down a path that's just going to get worse or not?
Very interesting question. All right. So I use a number of different modalities, and one of them is called the stages of change. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to assess where that individual is right now, and maybe they're in pre-contemplation, which is the layman's terms for ambivalence. They don't know whether they have a problem. So once again, like I said earlier, I'm going to meet that individual where they are, and I'm going to ask them some questions. What is your goal? What do you want to do? Can you commit to a program if we work together? So one of the things I try to do is move a person from pre-contemplation to even contemplation. It doesn't mean that they admit they have a problem. Maybe they're just going to take a look and see if they do have a problem. And by the way, that movement from pre-contemplation to contemplation is not a fine line. It's a chasm like the Grand Canyon. That's a lot of movement from ambivalence to contemplating. Maybe I need to take a look at that. So once again, I'm going to meet the person where they are, and I'm going to facilitate the process of change to their speed and their pace rather than force it. I'm going to always move as they move. So that means that I have to be flexible enough to use a number of different modalities, because as that individual is changing, if I use the same technique, they're going to look at me and say, hey, wait a minute, you're not moving with me and you're not being flexible. I'm asking them to have psychological flexibility, but they also need me to move with them. If they're getting better, I can't use the same modality or technique. They're going to think, wait a minute, can't you see that I'm getting better? So I think, once again, the premise is meet them where they are. And as they're changing, then I need to change with them and offer them something different to get them to where they want to go.
That's pretty amazing. That's impressive. Can you tell from the beginning if someone, you know, that you're working with is going to be on the path to getting better? What is their, how do they respond to you? What is the triggers, the clues that sit there and go, this person is committed versus somebody who's just, you know, maybe trying to appease a judge because they got a DUI?
Right. So you're asking the question of whether a person is complying with something and whether they're surrendering. So that's a really good question. I can't tell by their intellectual capacity or the things that they say or they don't say. I kind of look at nonverbals. And one of the things that I see is if they're closed off and they don't want to receive what I have to say or what the program has to say, then it's going to be extremely difficult. So there has to be some ability to surrender and accept where that individual is. However, even if there's no movement at all, once again, I'm just going to meet them where they are right now. And what they're exhibiting to me is the inability or maybe the lack of desire to address it right now. But that doesn't mean that I can't engage them at another time. So I don't give up on them. I just ask them, okay, what would you like to do? And it always is an incumbent upon them. And I give them back, you know, the control and say, what would you like to do? Not only in this session, but if they're in a program, I'm going to ask them, what is your goal? What would you like to accomplish? And I'm going to help them and facilitate that goal once they express it. But if they say, hey, you know what? I don't know why I'm here. I'm just going to meet them right there. I'm just going to accept that that's exactly where they are right now. It doesn't mean that they're not going to change later. So I'll probably stay with them for a bit. And as I see just maybe a crack, then I'm going to help them with that as much as I can, as much as that individual allows me to assist them. Does that make sense?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, for me, obviously being in recovery, I was at a place where I didn't feel like I can go any lower. And if I did go any lower, I was afraid of where that was going to be. With our family obligations, work, et cetera, those I love around me, very concerned. I got to the point where it was like, I need to seek help. And the first round, which was about 30 days before I physically went into an in treatment program, I thought that I was doing the best that I could do. And it really came down to the fact that, no, I need to basically be put into a place where I have no longer access to the things that I'm addicted to. Do you recommend that for anybody who's questioning it? Because for me, we can all say, you know, I'm good 5 days out of the week. But if that's my cycle, right? I mean, does that mean then if they go, no, I'm going to stop, so now I'm not going to do it on the weekends now? Is that habit that ingrained, or is it something that's easier for someone versus that person that has to drink every night or use every night to survive? What do you think the difference is? What are the opportunities?
All right. There is a myth floating around that in order to help an individual, they have to hit rock bottom. So that's a myth, because either we need to raise the bottom up for that individual, or we need to meet them. Once again, I keep saying this and I sound like a broken record, but meeting them where they are. So whatever they present is where I'm going to meet them. So whatever condition or whatever situation they're expressing, I'm going to help them with that. If they say, okay, you know what? I don't drink during the week, but I only drink on the weekend. Okay, I'm going to ask them, so how do you drink? What is the frequency of use and what happens? And also, what is the intent when they're drinking or using? Are you intending to get intoxicated? Are you intending to use a mind-altering substance to change your mental landscape? If that's true, then even though they're just using on the weekend, that would probably point toward a substance use disorder. And sometimes we see that as a binge drinker or binge user, right? They only use on a weekend. That doesn't mean they don't have a problem. But what I think at that point is I turn into a mirror and show them their behavior, and they can kind of look at it and go, oh, wait a minute. Maybe I do have a problem, even though I'm only using on the weekend. And vice versa, if they're drinking every day and they're saying to me they only have one or two drinks, is that a problem? Well, it potentially could be, because if that person needs one or two drinks, or they need to smoke a blunt or whatever, 1 or 2 days or 3 days out of a week, or maybe 4 or 5 days out of a week, and this is a normal routine that they do, then maybe they've developed a psychological habit. So it depends, once again, on the individual, what they're dealing with, what they're presenting, which means I've got to listen to them intently and actively to kind of figure out how can I help this individual, or even more importantly, am I going to be able to help that individual? Because guess what? I'm not going to be able to help everybody. So that individual might be need to be referred out to somebody else who is better capable of helping them, because maybe that individual's out of my scope of competence.
Understand. It's interesting because as you're explaining that, you know, my addict mindset goes, well, but what else am I going to do on the weekends? And that's my thing. That's what I do. And for me, you know, once the brain starts doing that, I sit there and I recognize that, well, this is really becomes potentially a mental health issue now too. Right. Yes. I mean, having a disorder, right, is a mental disorder. Right. And so you have to start questioning, you know, and being open and honest with yourself about potential, you know, depression issues, anxiety issues. Right. And those things, unfortunately, are exacerbated by drug use. Right. It's a circular wheel. Right. Yeah. And one of the things that's been made, you know, brought to my attention recently is the fact that, you know, trauma in a person's life also, you know, chemically changes the brain and its responses, its pleasure centers, in the same way much that addictions can. Yes. And so, this obviously could become a perpetuating issue as well for someone who's, you know, I just lost my house, right? I just lost my job. My wife died 6 months ago. You know, I've experienced all these traumas, and this is the only thing that's keeping me up is my addiction. But they'll never call it that at that time, right? They'll just simply call it, I do this to help myself feel better. right? And it's never even a point to feel good anymore. It's just to feel okay. And that's something that I think that a lot of people that are struggling don't recognize, that, you know, because there's so much guilt and shame tied into what we have going on with this thing. You know, it's a four-letter word, right? Addiction is a four-letter word. It's not, you know, it's not viewed by society. And I think that fortunately the last decade has been good for getting, you know, the general understanding for people that don't have the addiction gene, don't have the tendencies, don't classify it as normies, if you will, right? That don't understand these things, you know, even, you know, family members of addicts, right? That have never, that the family doesn't see anything whatsoever. What would you say to a family member who sits there and goes, I'm telling this kid to stop drinking or quit smoking dope or quit using heroin, and he just doesn't listen to me. What am I going to do with them? I don't see what the problem is, why he just can't stop. What is your response to somebody like that, like a family member?
So with family members, it starts with education, right? Because a lot of times they don't know the struggle. They don't understand addiction. They don't understand the dynamic over the process of it. So what I would explain to a family member is that when there is trauma, okay, let me back up. Our brains were made as human beings to connect. We connect to family, friends, communities, organizations, clubs, so on and so forth. Our brains were actually designed to connect. That's how we survived all this time. We were social creatures. We grew up in, or were raised up in tribes. We're going back 3,000 years or more, right? What happens when we've suffered trauma is the brain actually rewires from connection to protection. So I don't want to feel pain anymore. So I'm going to protect myself by isolating. I'm going to do things. I don't want to feel the pain. And a lot of times the public who is unaware and uneducated, they think it's a lack of moral character or a lack of willpower, or they're just degenerates or whatever. And that's not true, because I found in my experience in my 38 years that addiction is a development and a response to pain. So these individuals are suffering pain, either emotional pain, mental pain, spiritual pain, psychological pain, and sometimes even physical pain. And as a result of that, they've developed an addiction. So what I would do with a family member is I would ask this question. Have you watched them over the years, and have you seen them kind of having to deal with depression, anxiety, stress? Maybe they have a mental health disorder. Maybe they're bipolar. They have borderline personality disorder, schizoaffective, something that is they're dealing with, that they're struggling with. And also they've had some type of significant trauma. For instance, loss of a job, loss of a loved one. They had to foreclose on a home. They were offered a $200,000 position, but right at the last minute, the rug got pulled out from under them. And then all of a sudden, they're like, oh, now what do I do? Those are traumatic events. Also, if a person has been diagnosed with a terminal illness, so now their whole life is turned upside down, and that is a traumatic event. And all of a sudden, I won't say all of a sudden, the reaction to that is, wow, I don't know how to deal with that. I don't have the coping skills to deal with that. So then I'm going to reach, or that person's going to reach for a mind-altering substance in order to numb themselves to the point where the brain gets hijacked. And now I don't have the choice of not using. That's been taken away from me because of the habitual use. And now I no longer cannot use, which is the very definition of a compulsive disorder. I no longer have the choice to say I don't want to use. So it has nothing to do with lack of willpower. It has nothing to do with the fact that the person is not ethical. It doesn't mean that they're ingrate or degenerate. It just means that this is their reaction to trauma or to no longer feel pain. So I guess if I was talking to the general public, I would ask him to show compassion, kindness, and love, and tolerance, and surrender. And if we use all of those things, we can actually help the 85% of the people that need to be in treatment that aren't being treated because of the stigma that's attached to substance use disorders.
Wow. Thank you, sir. It's a great explanation. You know, when I, I obviously dealt with more than just alcohol. I dealt with marijuana use for a good couple of decades. And there were periods of time in which I stopped drinking because it was getting out of hand. One of the things that that I recognize now is that as I stay further and further away from substance use, right, the more my brain goes, hey, you know what? I can go back, you know, because I've got control of it now. I've shown myself that I can stop doing all these things for a substantial period of time. So now at the very least, you know, and it's almost, you know, the devil playing tricks on our minds. It's, you know, I can reward myself because I've controlled the beast that has controlled me for so long. But I recognize that through my relapses in alcohol use, that that's definitely not the case. And I had good stints. I had 6 years plus, you know, twice where I'd quit drinking. Of course, I was using other substances to basically manage my life, but to me, they didn't look the same. It wasn't on the same parallel. It was more of the, you know, the marijuana use was more like, well, this is doctor prescribed. It's now legal on top of that. This is, you know, this is good. This is okay. And so I just don't drink, you know, because that was like the devil for me. You know, fast forward 6 years later and go, I've got this all under control. I start drinking within a year. I'm like, I have to stop. I lay off for 6 years again, boom, start again. And then 18 months into it, I'm literally, I've taken such a steep nosedive that I have to admit myself into something very intensive because I'd recognize that I was reckless. And the scariest part about it was that I had lost like a verve for life. There was nothing. And that scared the living out of me. So I'd felt like I was depressed and I had massive anxiety and nothing mattered to me anymore. And at the same time, I knew the alcohol wasn't fixing the problem. What do you say to somebody that has maybe relapsed? That is, hey, you know, I did this all on my own. 6, 7, 10 years, and then I started drinking again. For some reason, it got away from me again. I don't understand my brain as to why I was able to do that then, and now I'm back at the same type of issue. What would you say to somebody like that?
The first thing I would say to a person who is either lapsed or relapsed is that don't look at that as a mistake. Far too frequently, an individual in recovery looks at a relapse as if they've failed or they've made a mistake. And what I tell that individual is, no, you have not made a mistake. It is not a failure. What I tell people is, look, you've been able to accumulate 6.5, 7, 8, 9, 11 years of sobriety. You already know how to do that. Nobody drilled a hole in your head and tipped it to the side and all that recovery information ran out. I asked them that, and I said, no, that didn't happen. I said, okay, you have all that information still in your head. So it doesn't, I don't want it to be a fatal thing or some type of catastrophic event, and did you think you can't continue? Because in all actuality, in many cases, that relapse or that lapse actually strengthens recovery when the person goes right back to the recovery behavior, which they knew how to do. What I also would tell them is the moment that they feel that they have control over their addiction has control over them. That C word that you used, that's an illusion. So I'm going to ask them, whatever it was that you need to learn that you didn't pick up during your last recovery stint, go ahead and learn what that is. Get right back on the horse and ride. It's not like you have to start all over again. Now, there are certain programs that will say, okay, your sober days go back down to zero. And I agree with that. But it doesn't mean that they have to go all the way back to the beginning. For instance, if a person is already in maintenance recovery, they have more than 1 year of sobriety, they don't have to go back to pre-contemplation in the stages of change. That's the very beginning. They're already been able to maintain their sobriety. I would just ask them, okay, what is it that you didn't pick up the first time or the second time? You found out that you can't isolate. You found out that you don't do well when you're depressed. You found out that you don't take disappointment very well, and your reaction to that is that you used. Okay, wonderful. Now you know something, and you're going to add that as a trigger on your relapse prevention plan. Okay, great. Just add it to your plan, and let's just keep going. and keep working. And that's one of the things that I would tell somebody who has lapse or relapse. And let me tell the difference between, because some people probably want to know the difference between a lapse and relapse, right? So Terence Gorski talks about a lapse being an individual who has used, they have a using episode, but in the middle of it, in the midst of the using episode, they have immediate remorse and they say, oh my goodness, what have I done? I had 177 days clean and now I messed it up by drinking. But here's the key. They stop right there. They stop using, they put the beer bottle down, or they stop snorting that line of cocaine, or they stop smoking that blunt, and they go, hey, whoa, 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 you know what? I don't like where I'm going. I don't like where I'm heading. I'm going to turn right back. And this is the 180 turn back to the recovery behavior. And the key is that they had remorse and they don't continue the behavior. So Gorski calls that a lapse. Now, a relapse is when an individual has a using episode, they don't tell anybody because they have no intention of stopping. And they could be out there for weeks, months, and sometimes years. That's a relapse. And then I would talk about a prolapse, an individual that is thinking about using, but they start using their recovery skills and their strategies that they've developed that they have in their toolbox. And then they say, no, I don't want to do that. Do they have the urge? Yes. Do they have a craving? Yes. Was there a trigger? Yes. But they didn't use, Gorski calls that a prolapse. And a person can have as many prolapses in recovery because it supports their recovery behavior. Because they don't use, and then their neural pathway in the brain is, hey, you know what? Even in the midst of difficulty and hardship and maybe even crisis, I didn't use. And now that's a neural pathway that's been developed that just gets wider and wider every time I have a crisis, but I didn't resort back to my old behavior. Then that neural pathway widens. And then I realize I can make it through hardship and difficulty without using. So that's what I would tell somebody who says, hey, Michael, you know, I relapsed and I feel like I'm a failure. I said, no, please do not use the word failure. Do not use the word mistake. Don't use the word fatal, because none of that is fatal. It's not a mistake. It's not something that you need to be ashamed of or embarrassed or guilty about, right? So that's what I would tell somebody.
Thank you for that. You know, what's interesting is that, you know, the times in which I stopped, you know, one substance, I had this notion that, you know, I was so strong-willed. Mm-hmm. I had the capability. I didn't need to go see any help, right? And with quitting, you know, cold turkey, with not seeking any guidance and just literally determining that this was purely just a matter of mind over matter, I recognize that, you know, now having gone through all the treatment that I have, that way is actually with lack of a better word to use, that isn't, I guess, your best option. Mm-hmm. You know, I would tell somebody now, don't do it that way, because unfortunately, unless you have the tools, right, to understand, you know, what to do, you know, in maintaining sobriety, you're inevitably going to potentially put that energy into it in a negative way into something else that may just do nothing but distract you. And you're going to, you know, for lack of a better term, you're going to white knuckle it in your life, and right. And you're going to be miserable. Mm-hmm. You know, you're most likely will end up miserable, worse off than what you were before. And I've met people like that have said, you know, I don't know why I quit drinking, life is shit. And it's like, well, maybe, you know, there's, you know, maybe you're not doing it right, partner. You know, and then I guess that's, you know, one of the things I kind of wanted to end up with, you know, you on is that, you know, when I made this decision and everything, it was like, I knew what my life was like with, and I needed to see behind the curtain of what my life was like without. If there was one thing, you know, that you, I mean, outside of all the gems you've given us tonight, if there's one thing that you could do to somebody who's suffering and seeking help, you know, what's the one thing that you wish that they knew?
Okay, so it's very interesting that you asked that question. So I would tell somebody, and you hit the nail on the head in terms of not thinking that they have to do it by themselves. Not only by themselves, but do it unassisted. So I am a firm believer in MAT, medication-assisted treatment, because I've seen it work. Now, some of my old school colleagues are going to rake me over the coals for this because there is some controversy about medical assisted treatment. For instance, if you have a heroin addict that has been using heroin for 10 to 12, 15 years, and they're having difficulty staying clean and sober. They've tried over and over and over again. Well, it might be beneficial for that individual to be prescribed Suboxone to help them, because Suboxone, the metabolite of it, occupies the same receptor sites as the heroin did, right? And then so they, even if they used on top of the Suboxone, they're not going to experience the euphoria. Plus, it aids in the craving for heroin. So with alcoholics, you can use naltrexone, or you can use Vivitrol. So there's medication-assisted treatment to help those individuals along, because there's sometimes that 72 to 96 hours initially, which is very, very difficult, particularly when they're in withdrawal and they're detoxing, and they might need some assistance to help them through that. And then as they're getting through that, then that assistance allows them to get through the detox without so much pain. Because and when I say old days, I'm talking in 1984, we didn't have medication-assisted treatment. So a person actually, particularly heroin addicts, it was very kind of archaic or kind of primitive how we actually detox people in a psych ward. And we would put them in a quiet room, and, you know, a heroin addict would have fluids coming out of every orifice of their body. And basically it wasn't very pretty. And we'd come in with a hose and we'd hose the floor down, and there was a drain in the middle. I mean, it looked prehistoric, you know what I'm saying? Now we don't do that. We're able to prescribe Suboxone or Subutex or Naltrexone or Vivitrol to help them through that. And even individuals that have severe or chronic depression, we have, you know, ketamine-assisted treatment, right, or ketamine-assisted therapy. So people don't have to go through the pain and all the suffering when they're detoxing and they're in withdrawal, because that is the pain. They don't want to feel the pain. And that's generally why heroin addicts or alcohol use disorder individuals will use, because they don't want to feel the pain. So we call it what? Licking the hair of the dog. They'll drink so that they don't go in withdrawals and have seizures. I understand the reasoning behind that. However, prescribing medication to help them through that period can help them sustain the recovery beyond just the withdrawal and, you know, the prolonged relapse period.
Very good, Michael. Thank you. I appreciate this tremendously. You know, with that being said, you know, the floor is yours. Are you still offering private practice, you know, services and things of that nature?
Yes, I am. I would tell people I'm new school in one area. I'm old school everywhere else. New school in one area. I don't have business cards. But if an individual is ready to change and they actually feel that they need assistance, I would ask them to go to steppingstonestohealing.net. And if they click on that website, they can contact me. It says, let's talk. And once a person clicks on that, they can indicate what kind of help that they're seeking. And then it'll go directly to, you know, a person that will actually, my office manager will field that, and then they can go from there, and we can offer assistance for them.
Wonderful, Michael. I tremendously appreciate your time this evening. Looking forward actually to the next episode, where we're dealing with someone who is in recovery, and she's going to share everything that she's learned about herself, about recovery, and about the new wonderful life that she's living now. So with that, I wanted to say thank you, Michael. Good night, friends and family, and good luck and God bless.
Thank you for having me.